3. Dorchester Heights, Massachusetts, March 4, 1776, 5:42 p.m. His Excellency General George Washington is apprehensive. The evening air thunders with rebel cannon. Flames belch from the cast-iron barrels with each blast, illuminating the sky over Boston Harbor. Washington watches with approval, mounted on the back of Blueskin, a spirited white half-Arabian horse who sometimes grows skittish at the sounds of battle. Footnote: at a time when superior equestrian skills were required of all true gentlemen, Washington was known for his prowess on horseback. He was fond of leaping fences and galloping across fields during day-long fox and stag hunts. The general had two primary mounts during the Revolutionary War, Blueskin and Nelson, a chestnut gelding who was known for his calm under fire. Washington rotated the daily use of the two horses in order not to overwork them. He also refused to whip his mounts and made it a habit to visit their stables first thing every morning to check on their well-being. End footnote. Within moments, after 8 months of waiting, Washington hopes to deliver a cruel and hopefully deadly blow to the British Army. Despite the welcome presence of his beloved Martha, who has traveled from Virginia to be with him at his headquarters in Cambridge, the Massachusetts winter has been a long and bitterly cold challenge for the general. Shortages of cannon, muskets, and gunpowder have limited his ability to wage war on the British forces who occupy Boston. The soldiers in his army are deserting in droves, done in by a winter so cold that men actually freeze to death on guard duty. Nevertheless, Washington imposes strict discipline on his troops, hoping to counter the boredom of the months-long stalemate with the British Army. The initial euphoria of being named Commander-in-Chief has long since passed for Washington, replaced by the fear that he has made a very big mistake. "I have often thought how much happier I should have been if, instead of accepting a command under such circumstances, I had taken my musket on my shoulders and entered the ranks," he has written to a friend. 4 times since July, Washington has presented to his Council of War detailed plans to attack Boston, and 4 times the Council has voted him down. Footnote: rather than rely solely on his own wisdom and recognizing the need for good advice before making major decisions, Washington convened a Council of War. Its members consisted of Major General Charles Lee, Major General Artemus Ward, and 4 other men who would rise to prominence as generals in the Continental Army: farmer William Heath, lawyer John Sullivan, physician John Thomas, and Major General Nathaniel Greene. Washington was not bound by their decisions, but he tended to defer to the council. End footnote. During a February cold snap, Washington was consumed with a far-fetched scheme to send thousands of troops across the frozen waters of Boston Harbor. Yet that plan was doomed to failure, as Washington was overruled by his more practical-minded generals. Cannon on British warships anchored offshore would have made short work of his army. The hard truth is that Washington has a very small band of soldiers under his command, many of whom do not yet believe they can defeat the mighty British. The only way to change their minds is actually to fight. Washington's men know that their cause is just. Now they need to know that their leader is able. For 2 days, beginning at midnight on March 2nd, American cannon have pounded the besieged city of Boston. The British Army has responded in kind, firing salvo after salvo at the American artillery batteries atop Cobble Hill, Lechmere's Point, and Lamb's Dam. Such exchanges have become purposeful. The Americans fire because they want to keep the British pinned down in Boston and to remind the 500 redcoats hunkering within their Bunker Hill fortifications that they can go no farther. The British fire back to assure the Americans that any attempt to attack Boston on the ground will be answered in force. On nights when there is no shelling, rebel gunners can hear the sounds of taverns socializing and city life carrying across the bay on the wind. On nights when their cannon fire so often that the barrels glow, These same men hear the distant screams of women and children being driven from their homes by crashing cannonballs. As if that anguish were not enough, some Patriot artillerymen wonder if those screams are those of their own wives and children. Women are already playing a crucial role in the war effort, managing homes and businesses while their husbands man the front lines. The women had little choice in this matter, just as the men who are rebelling had no choice but to leave their families behind in Boston, there to endure the hardships of life under British martial law. The harsh rigor of British tyranny rose to new heights 2 years ago, in 1774, when the British Parliament passed the punitive Boston Port Act. This law closed Boston to all commercial shipping until the city made complete restitution for the cargo dumped in the harbor during what has become known as the Boston Tea Party. Overnight, shipwrights, sailors, coopers, and dock laborers who formed the majority of Boston's working men lost their jobs. "It is now a very gloomy place," one Boston resident wrote to friends in England. "The streets are almost empty, and many families have departed." That was just the first exodus. 1 year later, in April 1775, the British expelled thousands of patriots after the skirmishes at Lexington and Concord. Entire families suspected of rebel activity were forced to leave their homes, not knowing if they would ever return. The causeway connecting Boston to the mainland became choked with these instant refugees, men and women leading their children while pulling carts laden with all their earthly possessions. Most spent that summer roaming the countryside in search of work and a place to sleep. By winter, homes throughout the colony became hostels for the displaced. Following a plea by the colonial government, it has become common for Massachusetts homeowners to invite refugees into their homes. Some kind souls even provide lodging for two or three entire families. Among them is 31-year-old Abigail Adams. "Every town is filled with the distressed inhabitants of Boston," she writes to her husband John, still serving as a delegate to the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia. The Adamses live on a farm in the town of Braintree, due south of Boston, but close enough that cannon fire keeps Abigail awake at night. "It would make your heart ache to see what difficulties and distresses the poor Boston people are driven to," she writes her husband. Abigail Adams herself knew such loss. Her mother and her niece died of smallpox within weeks of each other in October 1775. But it is not just American patriots who face hardship. Citizens of Massachusetts still loyal to King George are also being forced from their homes. As those being evicted from Boston jam the causeway on their way out of town, British loyalists travel in the opposite direction, headed into Boston to find sanctuary after months of being abused by fellow colonists for their allegiance to the king. Whether patriot or loyalist, most displaced families long to return home once hostilities end. They can only pray that their vacant houses will not be vandalized and the remainder of their possessions not plundered. Those prayers will go unanswered. In Boston, despite orders prohibiting the looting of private property, British soldiers make it a habit to enter abandoned homes and take what they like. It is even worse for the loyalists. Massachusetts patriots are already in the process of permanently stripping homes and businesses from their possession. They can never come back again. The Boston that George Washington now sees is a closed city, a collection of destroyed homes and filthy boulevards inhabited by a starving, war-weary populace eagerly praying for summer. The only way in or out is with a special pass. Survival takes many forms. For ladies of the night, there is no difference between patriot and loyalist. Though the British soldiers may be short on food, they are still getting paid. The prostitutes of Boston ply their trade in the red light district known as Mount Whoredom, risking not just syphilis and gonorrhea, but the spread of lice that comes with intimate human contact. Footnote: incredibly, Mount Whoredom is now one of Boston's most affluent neighborhoods, Beacon Hill. End footnote. Throughout the city, the dirty snow is covered in human waste. Garbage fills the streets, fueling an epidemic of diarrhea, dysentery, food poisoning, malnutrition, pleuritical disorders, respiratory infections, arthritis, rheumatism, scurvy, and typhoid typhus, in the words of one resident. In September 1775, General Thomas Gage receives news from England that he has been relieved of command because of his failures at Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill. The new commander in Boston is General William Howe, a dark-haired, brooding, extremely wealthy 46-year-old career soldier who spends most nights in the arms of a Boston Loyalist's wife. Footnote. The actual extent of Howe's relationship with Mrs. Loring is uncertain. Allegations began in New York in early 1777. Although they were both in Boston before that, it is not certain whether their affair began there. The authors of this book have used the version of events put forth by most modern writers. End footnote. Elizabeth Loring is blonde, blue-eyed, and at age 31 has just given birth to her first son. Despite having a newborn at home, Mrs. Loring gambles and drinks most evenings at General Howe's side, sometimes losing enormous sums in a single hand. One local paper describes her as a brilliant and unprincipled woman, while Howe's staff simply calls her the Sultana. Mrs. Loring's husband has learned how to accept the gossip about his wife's affairs and ignores those who call him a cuckold. Footnote. It was not uncommon for British generals to leave their spouses at home and take a mistress while away at war. Sometimes these affairs were in the open, as with the unmarried Howe and Mrs. Loring. Other times, the consorts were disguised as cousins and took up residence at a general's headquarters. However, the case of Mrs. Loring became such a public distraction that it attracted the attention of both the Continental Army and the British Parliament. American General Charles Lee said of Howe, "He shut his eyes, fought his battles, drank his bottle, and had his little whore." Parliament condemned Mrs. Loring as a Cleopatra to this Antony of ours. End footnote. And for good reason. The British government has rewarded Joshua Loring Jr. well. Born in Hingham, Massachusetts in 1744 and raised as a staunch British loyalist, Loring was appointed to the lucrative position of Boston's vendue master and auctioneer, which allowed him to earn commissions on the sale of captured goods. "He fingered the cash," one British observer will later write. "The general enjoyed madam." The British general is over 6 feet tall, like his foe George Washington. Howe's courage under fire has never been questioned. As commander-in-chief, Howe is responsible for the entire population of Boston, military and civilian, and the city is a chaotic place after residents have fled and refugees have poured in. In November, as the weather gets colder and troops must be moved from encampments into quarters, he makes the difficult decision to send 300 civilians out of the city and into American lines. "Destitute of almost everything, in the most miserable and piteous condition," George Washington wrote of these men, women, and children who were sent on boats to the mainland northeast of the city. Meanwhile, Howe and his officers socialize, spending their nights attending concerts and plays, drinking and gambling. One general, Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne, spends much of the winter writing and producing well-attended theatrical plays before he is finally ordered home to London. British regular soldiers are not as refined. They battle the boredom of winter garrison duty in the manner of occupying armies since the dawn of war, getting falling down drunk, chasing whores, and repressing the locals. Drinking has long been a staple of life in Boston despite its Puritan origins, yet the debauched behavior of the British soldiers is so appalling that it is a common worry among local women that it will have an adverse effect on their children. Those fears pale in comparison with the threat of greater abuses. For even though martial law is in effect and the punishment for rape is death, it is impossible to prevent crime in a garrison of 10,000 bored, opportunistic soldiers. Footnote. British soldiers enlisted for life, with terrible pay, the modern equivalent of 20 cents per day, and cramped living conditions. Thus, the need to maintain strict discipline to prevent mutiny was paramount. Even during the siege of Boston, General Howe inflicted severe punishments upon British soldiers for breaking the rules. Methods of discipline ranged from whippings to hanging, depending on the offense. Hangings were carried out on the Boston Common for all to see. If the punishment was flogging, the accused was stripped to the waist, tied to a tree or post, then lashed across the back with a whip known as a cat-o'-nine-tails. The name comes from the number of knotted cord tentacles attached to the whip handle. It was not uncommon for a soldier to receive several hundred lashes. It was considered bad form to cry out or flinch during this punishment, so soldiers very often crushed a lead bullet between their teeth while being whipped to counter the pain. In some extreme cases, the lashings were administered over the course of several days, which would not allow the wounds to close before the administration of more punishment, thus making the ordeal far more painful. The cat-o'-nine-tails would become covered in blood during a whipping. When not in use, the cat was very often kept in a bag made of coarse crimson cloth. The color was deliberate, meant to blend with the blood seeping through the fabric. The act of removing the whip from this storage pouch gave rise to the term "cats out of the bag," as a method of referring to a revelation. End footnote. One British officer will write home describing the British attitude toward violently defiling American women. A girl cannot step into the bushes to pluck a rose without running the most imminent risk of being ravished, and they are so little accustomed to these vigorous methods that they don't bear them with the proper resignation, and of consequence, we have the most entertaining courts-martial every day. Beyond the fortified city, the entire Boston harbor is ringed by artillery, all except a set of low, barren hills at the windy southern entrance. This area is known as Dorchester Heights. Just as Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill control the high ground to the north of Boston, so the heights overlook the city from the south. Both the British and Americans keep a sharp eye on this vital tactical location, but it remains unoccupied. The base of the heights is a collection of farmhouses, fields, and orchards, but the hillsides are completely exposed, making it easy for either side to bombard any troops erecting fortifications. Even if the slopes weren't so vulnerable, the cold winter has frozen the soil to a depth of 2 feet, making it impossible to build foundations. Even more than Bunker Hill, possession of the Dorchester Heights, in the words of heavy-set British General Henry Clinton, is absolutely necessary for the security of Boston.
General Howe, commander of British troops in Boston, is even blunter. He promises that any rebel attempt to fortify the heights will be met with our full force.
For good reason. Should George Washington take control of Dorchester Heights, the high ground will allow his gunners to bombard the British day and night, while simultaneously closing the southern entrance of Boston Harbor to all British shipping. The British army would then be almost completely cut off. Any British ship trying to run the blockade would be within reach of the American guns. Most Americans, sympathetic to the rebel cause, have fled across the causeway.
The majority have settled in towns nearby, such as Braintree and Weymouth, while others have fled Massachusetts entirely to make a new life far from the fighting.
What remains in the city are British soldiers and colonists loyal to the king, suffering through the most wretched winter they have ever known. It is not just the single-digit temperatures and biting winds that have taken their toll, nor the blizzards that turn a ship into a cake of ice, in the words of one British admiral. Something as simple as writing a letter becomes a challenge, as the cold freezes ink inside quills. The misery is made all the more unbearable by Washington's military siege. He has deprived Bostonians of almost every amenity. The cattle that once grazed on Boston Common were slaughtered months ago, their grazing land replaced by a campsite for British troops. The vegetable gardens of summer are now covered in a deep layer of snow. What scant food that exists is greedily claimed by the wealthy and elite, leaving little for the poor and dying, soldier and citizen alike. Early in the winter, before the harbor iced over, it was possible for British ships to resupply the city with food, rum, and winter clothing. The frozen harbor, the foul weather, and the American privateers so fond of hijacking British cargo now make that impossible. The distresses of the inhabitants and troops in Boston exceed the possibility of description, one soldier writes in his journal. They are almost in a point of starvation for want of food or fuel. The inhabitants, totally destitute of vegetables, flour, and fresh provisions, have actually been obliged to feed on horse flesh, and the troops confined to salt provisions, by which means they have become sick. The British contempt for the civilian population, even those loyal to the king, is total. Citizens are beaten for no reason, the cries of the suffering almost completely unheard by the occupying forces. Firewood has become the essence of life. The city's trees have been chopped down, rows of church pews ripped out, and entire houses demolished to quench the need for kindling. Even worse than the cold and starvation is the smallpox. The disease is epidemic in Boston, taking far more lives than the war. Highly contagious and incredibly painful, smallpox starts with a flu-like fever and then develops into a rash with sores that cover the mouth, throat, and inside of the nose. Bleeding from the gums, orifices, and eyes occurs next. Soon, every part of the body, even the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet, are covered in painful bright red pustules. As the infection enters its second week, the victim begins to reek of decay and the pustules pop. There is no cure for smallpox, though some lucky victims recover. Others go blind. Many simply die. George Washington is well acquainted with the blinding headaches and crippling back pain that can precede the outbreaks of smallpox sores, having survived his own scare with the killer disease decades before. Footnote: Washington contracted smallpox in 1751 while visiting Barbados with his half-brother. The two men had traveled to the Caribbean island seeking a cure for Lawrence Washington's tuberculosis. On November 17th of that year, the 19-year-old George was stricken with smallpox. He endured 3 weeks of suffering before the illness passed, but in the process, he became an ardent believer in smallpox inoculation, a highly controversial practice at the time. It involved placing a small amount of pus from an infected victim into an incision on the body of a healthy person. This would result in a mild form of smallpox, one that could sometimes be fatal, but when successful, it gave the individual a lifetime of immunity from the disease. Thus, in 1776, as Martha Washington came to stay with her husband in Massachusetts, the general vigorously urged her to get inoculated. Despite great misgivings, she did, with no ill effects. It should be noted that Lawrence Washington's trip to Barbados was unsuccessful. He died of tuberculosis upon his return to Virginia in 1752. End footnote.
He is so concerned about the epidemic spreading to his troops that he will not allow any individual fleeing Boston to come in contact with his army, knowing smallpox can be transferred by something as simple as a handshake. Washington understands that the British may be making an even more deliberate attempt to use biological warfare against his troops. By recent information from Boston, General Howe is going to send out a number of the inhabitants in order, it is thought, to make more room for his expected reinforcements, Washington writes to John Hancock during the course of the winter. A sailor says that a number of these coming out have been inoculated with design of spreading the smallpox.
George Washington is now personally responsible for the siege of Boston. This makes him accountable for the suffering now being experienced by its inhabitants, British troops, loyalists, and their families. but Washington does not care. The general is known as a man of compassion, yet as one soldier writes, "George Washington possesses an inflexible firmness of purpose and is determined that discipline and subordination in camp shall be rigidly enforced and maintained." Washington has shot soldiers for desertion, flogged men who disobeyed orders, and once even erected a 40-foot-tall gallows to remind troops what would become of them if they did not do their duty. In a letter recently circulated among his troops, Washington made it very clear what would happen to any soldier refusing to do his duty. "If any man in action shall presume to skulk, hide himself, or retreat from the enemy without the orders of his commanding officer, he will be instantly shot down as an example of cowardice." So, if the general has no problem treating his own men in this manner, he surely doesn't give consideration to the British and their supporters enduring the deprivation brought on by the military siege. In fact, Washington's bold new plan of action will make their lives even more unbearable. The strategy begins to unfold just after dark on March 4th. After 2 days of firing, the British have become desensitized to the sound of American cannon. They do not expect an American ground attack, and they plan no offensive action of their own. As the rebel guns begin firing again, the British fire back as usual. In doing so, they play into George Washington's hands. The deafening pounding of the cannon now conceals the sound of hundreds of rebel infantrymen sprinting toward Dorchester Heights. Strategically placed sheaves of hay lining the road provide a protective screen, allowing the rebels to move into position without being seen or heard. Washington himself conducted some of the reconnaissance for this risky mission, and for good reason. The Continental Army has just come into possession of 59 British cannon and mortars captured in upstate New York. The general now plans to place them atop the heights. Footnote: American troops under General Benedict Arnold earned America's first victory of the Revolutionary War by capturing the British-held Fort Ticonderoga on May 10, 1775. 25-year-old Henry Knox from Boston, a bookstore owner who had yet to receive his commission in the Continental Army, boldly suggested the idea of retrieving the captured guns from Ticonderoga and dragging them to Boston by ox-drawn sleds. Washington put Knox in charge. The nearly impossible 300-mile journey through thick winter snow and ice took 56 days, but Knox successfully arrived in Boston on January 25, 1776, completing one of the most impressive military missions in American history. End footnote. The infantry is soon followed by an unlikely force of 1,200 men driving teams of oxen pulling carts piled high with pre-built log fortifications. A full moon will provide all the light they need to transport these loads to the summit of Dorchester Heights and set them in place. The night air is unusually warm, letting both men and animals labor without the hindrance of biting wind or a snowstorm. At the base of the heights, a low haze settles over the infantry as they cut down orchards and use the toppled trees to form a defensive line. But the real work takes place as the oxen slowly drag their heavy loads up the hillside. As Washington planned, the clank of harnesses and yokes is muffled by the night-long cannon fire. The men do their best to maintain silence, lest a sharp word carry across the water to Boston and alert the British. The whole procession moved on in solemn silence and with perfect order and regularity, one eyewitness will write, while the continued roar of cannon serves to engage the attention and divert the enemy from the main object. A first load of fortifications reaches the bluff top and is set in place. Then the oxen are guided back down the hill for another. While they are gone, a second rebel group, armed with pickaxes, goes to work on the frozen soil, slowly breaking up chunks of rock-hard earth that will fill spaces between the logs in the hastily erected fortifications. Fresh hay will be added, pressed into the gaps to form a solid seam that that will prevent even a sliver of British canister and grape from passing through. By 10 p.m., the fortifications are durable enough to withstand British cannonballs. And still, the Americans solidify their stronghold, working to exhaustion. At 3 a.m., a force of 3,000 men relieves the first shift. The pace quickens with the approach of dawn. Storage barrels are filled with rocks and sand. In case of a surprise British attack, the impromptu weapons will be rolled down the slopes at the advancing army. As the first rays of morning sun break the darkness over the Atlantic Ocean, the oxen no longer drag fortifications up the hill. Instead, they haul cannon. "These are the preparations," one soldier will write in his journal, anticipating that the British will send men across the harbor to do battle, "for blood and slaughter." The battle never comes. "My God," a stunned General Howe exclaims as he studies the new fortifications. "These fellows have done more work in one night than I could make my army do in 3 months." Howe's admiration is quickly replaced by action. He orders the rebels' fortifications to be tested with a withering cannon barrage. But, as Howe perhaps already suspected would happen, the British guns do little damage. Most cannonballs are deflected and cause little fear among the Americans. Throughout the long night of digging and the day of cannonading, just 2 rebel soldiers lose their lives. Even as the British pound the hillside, Washington gallops Blueskin up Dorchester Heights to congratulate his troops. "His Excellency General Washington is present, animating and encouraging the soldiers, and they in turn manifest their joy and express a warm desire for the approach of the enemy," one soldier will later write. George Washington has his first great victory, and he has yet to lead his men into battle. Footnote: Washington himself required his soldiers and officers to call him Excellency. The term, now frequently associated with popes and kings, was once more commonly used to signify status within an organization. The term often precedes another title, thus His Excellency General George Washington, signifying that Washington was separate and superior from the other generals in the Continental Army. It was a source of deep frustration to Washington that he was looked down upon by the British military leadership. Using this title was yet another way to show that he was their equal. Despite this, General Howe, in particular, refused to acknowledge Washington as anything other than a contemptuous rebel. End footnote. General Howe is not a fool. He knows his army will be destroyed if Washington continues to bombard the city. In return for a British promise not to burn Boston to the ground shortly after the occupation of Dorchester Heights, the Americans allow a flotilla of British ships to line up at the docks and load 8,000 redcoats in a humiliating evacuation of the city. Many of these men have lived in Boston long enough to take wives and start families, so these dependents are let on board as well. Hundreds of non-military civilians who consider themselves loyalists and who swear fealty to the king in spite of the rebellion also find their way into steerage. Among them are Boston's leading bankers, lawyers, preachers, ship owners, and politicians. These proud men who once dictated the ebb and flow of the city's daily life will never again be welcome to return. Footnote: Massachusetts passed a Banishment Act in 1778 prohibiting the return of certain individuals who once lived in the colony and expressed an abiding loyalty to the king. End footnote. Also on the ship are Elizabeth Loring and her husband Joshua. They will follow Howe's army, he being appointed to the important and well-salaried post of Commissary of Prisoners in New York, she becoming the focus of accusations that Howe never put his all into fighting the American War. George Washington is not just driving away the British army. He is ripping the Loyalist heart and soul out of Boston, and with great relish. There is no room for disloyalty in his world. On March 17, 1776, his army marches across the neck into Boston as a drum and fife play Yankee Doodle. It is a song the British have long used to deride the Americans as buffoons, but which the rebels have instead adopted as a badge of honor. In time, it will become their anthem. As the British fleet sails out into the Atlantic, Washington realizes he will have to confront his enemy in another place. King George is not going to cede the fight easily. Washington does not know where the next battle will take place. He suspects it will be in New York City.